This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the threat from domestic extremism. Over the last several years, the FBI and leading terrorism experts have been saying that domestic extremism and white supremacy represent a rising danger in the United States that overshadows the threat from militant Islamist groups. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The storming of the U.S. Capitol on January 6 is the latest and most disturbing manifestation of the threat posed by homegrown terrorists. Among the thousands who descended on Washington at the urging of former President Donald Trump were adherents to the QAnon conspiracy theory, white supremacists, anti-Semites, and members of far-right anti-government militia groups like the Proud Boys, Three Percenters, and Oath Keepers. Despite the thoroughly discredited allegations of voter fraud, then-President Donald Trump encouraged his supporters to challenge his loss to Democrat Joe Biden. His role in stoking the assault on a joint session of Congress prompted the House of Representatives to impeach him for, quote, inciting insurrection. The domestic extremists who heeded Mr. Trump's call became further radicalized in online chat rooms, which propagated disinformation and conspiracies regarding the 2020 election results. What is more alarming to terrorism experts and analysts is that among the array of anti-government protesters in the violent mob were members of the military and police officers. Some analysts worry that white nationalists and anti-government sympathizers may be infiltrating the ranks of the U.S. military and police forces around the country. So what tools does U.S. law enforcement have to apprehend, charge, and punish domestic terrorists? Ali Soufan, a former FBI agent, says, quote, "It is time for Congress to act by strengthening domestic terrorism statutes so the nation's prosecutors can leverage similar tools and legislation that exist for combating international terrorism," unquote. And just this week, the Wall Street Journal reports that, quote, "The Department of Homeland Security issued a national terrorism alert warning that violent domestic extremists could attack in the coming weeks, emboldened by the January 6 riot at the U.S. Capitol," unquote. Well, for more on the threat of homegrown terrorism and what can be done to prevent and fight it, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Daryl Johnson is one of the foremost experts on domestic terrorism in the United States. Previously a senior analyst at the Department of Homeland Security, he is now the owner of DT Analytics. That's a private consulting firm for law enforcement, academia, and other organizations. He is also the author of the recently published book, Hateland, A Long, Hard Look at America's Extremist Heart. And Jason Blazekas, he's a former State Department counterterrorism official, currently the director of the Center on Terrorism, Extremism, and Counterterrorism at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies in Monterey, California. He's also a senior fellow at the New York-based Soufan Center. And both gentlemen join me via Microsoft Teams. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol.
Great to be on the program, Carol. Thanks for having me.
Daryl Johnson, let me go to you first. Now, I'd rather not get into Mr. Trump's liability or even the woefully inadequate security at the Capitol on January 6th that allowed the mob of protesters to breach the Capitol. Rather, I'd like this discussion to revolve around what we're seeing, you know, a more brazen manifestation of this right-wing white nationalist anti-government domestic terrorism. We saw the attack on the Capitol. We've seen the attack on Michigan's governor, protests meant to subvert the democratic process. And of course, we've seen violent events previous to this, whether in Charlottesville, the Unite the Right rally, the massacre at Walmart in El Paso, the Tree of Life synagogue attack and so forth. But Daryl, my question to you, could you characterize this threat for us as you see it today?
So, Carol, what we're talking about on the far right are groups that are ultra-nationalistic. They wrap themselves in patriotism. We also have various hate groups that believe in the supremacy of the white race. So those are the two broad categories of extremist groups we have on the far right. What we've seen since 2009 is these groups have continued to grow and recruit and radicalize because of a number number of factors. First, it was the unprecedented election of Barack Obama, the first African-American president back in 2008, coupled with an economic downturn. These created fertile grounds for people to recruit and radicalize right-wing extremists. We now fast forward to 2020. We've got a pandemic. These individuals on the far right, particularly the anti-government groups, do not like the government regulation. They don't like wearing masks. They don't like being told how many people should assemble in a group or to stay at home. So they look at these things as infringements on their constitutional rights, and it's provided fertile ground for more recruitment and radicalization. Coupled that with the former president's continuous pandering of these groups on his Twitter accounts, encouraging them to liberate various states, to protest and to bring arms, and also agitating them with this notion of a rigged election and rampant voter fraud. So despite all of the evidence contrary from the courts, from Democrats, as well as fellow Republicans, there's still a segment of people in the United States that believe former President Trump, that this was a stolen election. And so we're going to continue to see these people agitated around that issue and radicalizing around it.
I'd like to turn now to Jason for your take. Anything to add or subtract to what Daryl just told us?
In terms of grievances, the anti-government groups in particular, their rise in the mid-1990s, I think, is an important learning point for us. The Ruby Ridge event in Idaho, where the Weaver family was surrounded by federal law enforcement and his wife was killed. The Waco, Texas cult led by David Koresh, the Branch Davidians, the situation in which federal law enforcement went in, and the result was a fire that led to the deaths of a number of the Davidians. The 1994 assault gun ban that the Clinton administration passed to limit the flow of assault weapons. These events, amongst others, led to a pronounced rise within the anti-government movement, culminating in the 1995 attack by Timothy McVeigh in Oklahoma City that killed more than 150 people in addition to small children. And that's when the federal government started taking events more seriously related to the anti-government groups as posing a threat to U.S. domestic interests. And I think we're at the same point today. That event, January 6th, the insurrection, the storming of the Capitol, to me was the equivalent, even though it didn't have the death toll, the symbolic equivalent of what Timothy McVeigh did in 1995. And it has, I think, energized law enforcement and the Biden administration to take the threat very seriously. And my concern moving forward is that this is an animated movement, but they're also going to be animated by the new administration and the policies the new Biden team will be adopting. They're certainly going to look at policy issues around gun control. They're going to become more involved in multilateralism. They're going to work within the context of the United Nations to counter terrorism and probably even to talk about the rise of the radical right throughout the world. And I think these policy issues that they're pursuing are going to be perceived by the anti-government groups like the Oath Keepers, the Three Percenters, as being a form of tyranny where the United States is being usurped somehow by the United Nations. And this is a common argument amongst the radical right in the United States, not just in anti-government groups, but with the white supremacists and street movements like the Proud Boys. That, coupled with the fact that the Biden team is going to perhaps lift immigration restrictions, perhaps not pursue a border wall. Also, this issue of immigration is going to motivate individuals as well on the right. So these are the things I'm observing, Carol.
That's a very interesting observation, Jason. Let me turn back to Daryl to pick up on some of the points you made. Daryl, some analysts say that these domestic extremists have become radicalized in much the same way as members of Al-Qaeda and other foreign terrorist groups. In fact, Ali Soufan of the Soufan Center has said this. They've been fed a steady diet of disinformation, taught that somehow violence is justified to achieve political ends, and that, for example, the First Amendment prevents law enforcement from surveilling or investigating Americans based solely on their political views, even if their views are deemed racist or anti-government. The law says it's a crime to provide material support to specially designated foreign terrorist organizations, but it doesn't seem there's a parallel for domestic groups which harbor extreme positions. What do you say to that?
Well, Carol, we're all human beings, and I think there are commonalities in the radicalization and recruitment process into these extremist organizations. The only thing that differs is really the environment in which the people are operating, as well as their personal life experience. So there may be differences in how a white supremacist will be triggered to carry out an act of violence here in America versus somebody over in the Middle East joining ISIS. So there are some parallels, but there are some unique differences. And you mentioned how the extremists here in America do use their constitutional rights to kind of hide behind, and it does create some difficulties on the part of the intelligence community and law enforcement to collect and monitor these people. So we have to take those things into consideration when we're developing strategies to combat these groups in the future. But we can work with other organizations that don't have those same limitations and restrictions. Our private sector social media companies don't operate like the government does. They don't have intelligence oversight. They don't have these prohibitions against monitoring people for criminal activity before it happens. So we need to develop strategies that build these relationships between private sector entities, social media companies, civil rights organizations, even these groups that have organized that are called exit programs, such as Christian Piccolini's Free Radicals organization. The government can work hand in hand with these types of groups and kind of get around some of these issues so that we can start really monitoring this threat and bringing all strategies and tools to bear on this problem.
Jason Blazekas, how do you see this dilemma between how the United States is able to apprehend and charge foreign terrorists much more easily than with these domestic terrorists that we're seeing on the rise?
So post 9/11, the United States shifted its focus from pre-9/11 focus on ethno-nationalist foreign-based organizations like the various Palestinian groups that were on the State Department list of foreign terrorist organizations, groups like Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. The U.S. wasn't really focusing on the global Salafi jihadist threat posed by al-Qaeda. Then, of course, 9/11 happens, and then the United States pivots its array of intelligence collection systems against the Salafi jihadist threat. Then fast forward to 2014 and the rise of ISIS, and again, kind of demonstrating the power of the Salafi jihadist threat. Fast forward to where we are today, the United States, its intelligence collection across the board, both internationally and domestically, isn't really well postured to go after this particular threat posed by anti-government groups and white supremacists based at home. So one of the first things I think the Biden team will need to do is to think about intelligence collection priorities, both overseas and domestically. What can the FBI do in terms of pivoting resources to get better collection and infiltrate the various groups that we're concerned about, like the Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, the Proud Boys? What can we do about those overseas movements that some of these organizations have links to? Because they certainly are talking with one another. You see transnational overseas groups like the Russian Imperial Movement talking to people who organized the Unite the Right rally, like Matthew Heimbach years ago in 2017. These connections are real. So that's the first thing I would do. The second thing I would do is I certainly would evaluate the laws that we possess to see where we have gaps, because, of course, we have a definition of domestic terrorism. Both DHS has one and the FBI has one. The FBI is pursuant to 18 U.S.C., the United States Code. But there's only really one domestic terrorism charge we can pursue against individuals who carry out an attack on the homeland. And that's for the use of a weapon of mass destruction to include other kinds of incendiary devices that aren't chemical, biological, radiological, or nuclear in orientation. People like Robert Bowers, who carried out the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting, he wasn't charged for an act of domestic terrorism because he used a handgun. So perhaps it's worth exploring, Congress debating the pros and cons of amending the laws to see whether or not we can actually charge individuals who carry out violent activity. And I think that's really important, that that activity has to be violent in orientation, with acts of domestic terrorism if they meet the definition that we have for domestic terrorism. It's really strange to me, Carol, that we have a definition of domestic terrorism, but we don't have a lot of charges that we can levy against individuals who are carrying out premeditated political acts of violence that lead to the deaths of individual civilians, all with an eye towards creating an atmosphere of fear. And I think we are living that environment of fear right now. And I think it is time to at least explore this, because certainly I think it is the case that some of these groups are hiding behind the First and Second Amendment protections. But the last thing I'll say is we need to be really careful as we evaluate the need for new laws to ensure that we don't overreach, that we don't further the grievances of these groups than their perceived view of the United States as being a tyrannical entity. Because there is that possibility that if we go too far, we could become a police state. And that's the last thing we need, Carol.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Our guests are Daryl Johnson, a leading expert on domestic terrorism and former senior analyst at the Department of Homeland Security, and Jason Blazekas, from whom you just heard. He is director of the Center on Terrorism, Extremism, and Counterterrorism at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies. We're discussing the insidious threat from domestic terrorism in the aftermath of the January 6th deadly assault on the U.S. Capitol. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. Well, here's a shout out to a faithful radio and social media fan from the DRC, Alphonse Nkongolu. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our program and back to you, Daryl Johnson. You both alluded to the role of social media because we're seeing the spread of disinformation, conspiracy theories in these online chat rooms. You know, we can't necessarily control the role of politicians like former President Trump or even Rudy Giuliani and others. But what about the role of social media? What is the best way to debunk these noxious conspiracy theories that are circulating and that people are consuming and somehow believing?
It's a daunting task because there's so much of it in this day and age of the internet. So I think it's incumbent upon the social media companies to develop policies and whatever type of enforcement that they want to take against people that are spreading these types of conspiracy theories. These things are at the root of motivation and radicalization. Disinformation, the conspiracy theories, these are the things that motivate people to violence. And I think we need to hold people accountable for creating these types of things, whether it's through a civil matter or through ostracizing them or having some sort of counter messaging platform that calls out these deliberate falsehoods. There are companies out there that police the internet and try to get to the root of these rumors and myths and conspiracy theories. Perhaps we can market these types of organizations for the research and work that they do to try to debunk these things. But it's incumbent upon, you know, every American to counter and refute these types of things when they hear it from a family member or a coworker or friend. And hopefully it'll have an impact on that person and get them to start thinking about how they could actually research themselves for the truthfulness of these things before accepting it as truth.
Jason Blazekas, Daryl Johnson makes some very good points. On the other hand, the echo chambers of these disinformation platforms are so intense. We're even seeing a right-wing media outlets like Newsmax or OANN traffic in outright misinformation. Many of these networks perpetuated what is now considered the, quote, big lie that somehow former President Trump really won the election. You know, how can we convince Americans of the objective truth? What are some measures that can be taken to debunk these conspiracy theories and falsehoods?
So that's a really difficult challenge that researchers are trying to answer. Part of the challenge, I think, stems from the fact that we have the death of local news. I remember growing up having a local newspaper that I could access, and my family read it, and it had verifiable facts. You had researchers and writers who actually put out stories that were based on factual information. Now we have an ecosystem in which you have news services that do bandy falsehoods. So what do you do about that? One thing I think, but it's going to take time, is that we invest early on at the elementary school level, the high school levels, in media and digital literacy. In media literacy, understanding your sources. Where is this publication coming from? what is its bias, so that the reader understands that perhaps that source could be trying to manipulate them. But that has to start really early on in the classroom. The second thing is digital literacy. People are living online increasingly more. And in that sense, people need to understand who they are digitally. How are individuals or organizations trying to manipulate them online? The second solution, I think, is there needs to be some level of accountability for large social media companies like Twitter, Facebook, Google, and YouTube. They are certainly allowing for disinformation to spread on their platforms. This is how people get their news right now, unfortunately, on their Facebook groups. And this news is often falsehood. So one thing former President Trump has said time and again, that we need to look at Section 230 of the Communications and Decency Act. There are, I think, small changes that can be done to Section 230 that would allow for Congress to compel social media companies to do better. For instance, these companies use algorithms to recommend the next video to watch or to follow somebody new on Twitter. If these algorithms are continuing to essentially encourage people to go to hate-filled pages or look at hate-filled tweets, then there needs to be accountability. So I think Congress should look at thinking about how they can hold to account the companies that allow these algorithms to continue to make these bad recommendations that continue to fuel the fire surrounding the spread of disinformation.
In the few minutes we have left, back to you, Daryl Johnson. I wonder if you could enlighten us a bit about what is known as insider attacks. What do we know about the tendency of some white supremacists applying for military or police forces, you know, the infiltration of our very security forces that we count on to protect us, having in their ranks people we can't really fully trust who don't have our best interests at heart? What do you know about that?
The military has had a longstanding policy that prohibits active participation in white supremacist groups. I think that that policy is outdated, given the internet. People affiliate with these groups and radicalize and get indoctrinated online. They're not really active members of any type of a group, per se. There's also no prohibition in the military for joining Three Percenters or Oath Keepers or other anti-government extremists. So that policy seriously needs updating and expanded to capture the broad range of extremism that we're talking about here. Because we do have an infiltration problem. Of the 150 people so far that have been arrested for the Capitol insurrection on various federal charges, 20% are members of the military, and we have approximately 30 police officers that were off duty at the time who are being investigated by the FBI for participating in this insurrection. So that just clearly shows you we do have a problem. And rather than looking at it from a criminal matter, we need to be looking at it from an administrative matter, whether these people are suited for their positions and whether they should be empowered with these law enforcement and military authorities.
Jason Blazekas, you get the last word on that.
It's a longstanding challenge. If you look at the major acts of domestic terrorism in the United States over time, at least in the 1990s, Timothy McVeigh, former military, carrying out the Oklahoma City bombing, then a series of bombings against abortion clinics, also former military. So this is a persistent challenge. And those stats that Daryl mentioned, aren't they startling? They really are. And it's a worry to me. So I agree with Daryl. This is an insider and intelligence threat challenge. In terms of where I would start thinking about devoting resources, Department of Defense has an office that's charged with looking at personnel security and suitability. And I think changing the way in which personnel are evaluated needs to be done very quickly. And I know members of Congress encourage the Department of Defense to have a paradigm shift in how they evaluate their personnel, perhaps new questions that maybe are more targeted and focused on trying to understand who's coming into the military. What are their social media accounts? What are their beliefs? Do any of those attune to at all white supremacist groups or street movements like the Proud Boys or anti-government groups? The Oath Keepers in particular, they make a concerted effort to recruit military and law enforcement. That's in their charter. And they are taking advantage of the U.S. training that we give our military and our law enforcement officials. The second thing I would do, practically speaking, is instead of buying these fancy tanks for wars we're no longer fighting, is investing perhaps more deeply in Air Force Office of Special Investigation. Those who are actually charged with investigating individuals for carrying out potential criminal activity. Those investments, I think, would go a long way in terms of trying to counter this internal challenge that we're facing in the United States today.
Gentlemen, for now, I'm afraid that's just about all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Daryl Johnson, owner of DT Analytics, and Jason Blazekas, director of the Center on Terrorism, Extremism, and Counterterrorism at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.